Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those above them. Today, Disrespect concludes our interview with Michael Shapcott of the Wellesley Institute talking about the impact of mixed-income housing on subsidy housing for disadvantaged people.
Toronto Community Housing Company has some absolutely good, excellent people, some of the best people in the housing business who are working for Toronto Community Housing, but it also is the second biggest landlord in North America. And I have to say...
Big problems, yeah.
Yeah, without any... disrespect to many dedicated people at Toronto Community Housing, it's hard to be a landlord of 60,000 people and to
yep.
be sensitive to the realities of individual households. And it just is a huge administrative issue, and administration becomes more important than people.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of smaller community-based housing providers, and
okay.
I don't think it's an either-or sort of situation, because certainly there can be abusive practices even in smaller, more intimate housing situations. But
the fact that you know your abusers might have some retarding effect on the extent of the abuse.
Yeah, again, the critical issue is we've got to take housing issues and housing concerns kind of out of the kind of fuzzy notions where they've been. And the fact is that there's I think maybe two really fundamental facts that most Canadians know. One is that the housing is generally speaking the single biggest expense for most Canadian households.
Yeah.
And secondly, we know that for an increasing number of Canadians, it's getting really hard for them to maintain their homes, whether they're living in a private rental unit, a subsidized public housing unit,
sure.
Or
rising values, rising taxes, rising heating costs.
You know, the whole gamut. And what we need to do is, you know, this notion that emerged in the 80s and 90s that somehow housing policy isn't really all that important, that we'll kind of let people figure it out on their own, or
yeah.
let private markets do it on their own, or we'll just let the public housing landlords go off and make do best they can without any help from our financial resources. All that has been a spectacular failure.
Yeah.
The most obvious evidence of that failure, unfortunately, is the growth in mass homelessness in the 1990s and 2000.
Yep.
And since, we've seen...
Which is unprecedented.
It is. And for a country like Canada, which in global terms is one of the richest countries in the world, and... we certainly can do a heck of a lot better, and we did used to do a heck of a lot better. But what we did was we kind of dropped the ball, and we thought that somehow housing doesn't really matter. It's not a fit subject for public conversation, and we'll just let other people sort of figure it out. We'll let the public housing landlords swing in the wind, and they'll do the best they can with little or no help. And what we've got now is, unfortunately, the fruit of all of that bad policy. The good news, however, is that it can actually be turned around.
Mm-hmm.
There are, even as we're facing what could be a capital R recession, but what certainly for most lower-income people is a recession in everything but the official sense of it, because people are experiencing declining incomes against rapidly rising costs for shelter, for food, for
the
other basics in life.
Worldwide crisis.
Yep, and it hasn't hit most Canadians as sharply as it's hit a number of other countries.
Because our dollar's risen,
But you know these things are extremely real, and we need to take them seriously. And
it's going to come back with a vengeance if the dollar declines.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so, you know, again, we go back to this to some fundamental questions, and you know, I think when it comes to fundamental public policy questions, asking simple questions like why and how, you often get branded as being radical and as being embarrassing for asking those questions. But I think those are the important questions. And so, you know, to go back to the start of our conversation and the question of mixing up upper-income people in neighborhoods with lower-income people, we need to ask the question, how exactly is that going to benefit poor people?
Yeah.
And you know, until we can start to answer some of those questions, I think we have to maybe drop a bit of the triumphalism about saying that you know, isn't it wonderful that rich people are going to come and live next door to poor people?
Yeah, yeah. So I would gather that what you say is that the I'm sorry, we've got somebody drilling with a pneumatic drill overhead. Hang on while I shut the door. see if I can reduce some of this noise. The noise is actually on the roof of the studio. But it seems that the answer that you're proposing that people look at then is different models for administering public housing, and that pneumatic drill doesn't help. Well, I've got it. Can you hear it in the background?
No, actually I can't.
Oh, good. Well, then it won't broadcast. But it's just like, between every sentence, it's like, and then, I'm sure they're chipping away concrete for some utilities or something.
Oh, yeah, or maybe some rich people are going to move in upstairs.
Thanks. It's just, we're in the middle of a live interview. I had another host wander into the studio. Okay. I recall what you were saying about the value of mixed-income housing, but its relative lack of value, uncombined with other strategies for addressing housing, and that we need to bring the federal and the provincial government into this, if only for more funding and more funding stability, and we need to look at different models of administering public housing, and we need to look at this quid pro quo with developers. We have something to offer them. What are we going to get in return?
Well, that's it. And you know, what it means is taking fundamental questions of housing policy and moving them out of the area of the kind of fuzzy thinking and actually do a little bit of more sharply focused thinking. You know, over the years, if you look at housing policy, let's go back to the late 1940s when Regent Park was
conceived,
was being proposed, and then in the late 1940s it was actually being developed. All of the smartest people back then, and I don't mean that to be facetious, all the smartest architects, planners, and so on said the best thing for poor people is to get them into nice new housing, to give them lots of grass and green areas to play in, and
divide this from the rest of the city.
Yeah, and you know, the people really thought that they were doing a huge favor to poor people by moving them into the Regent Park development.
Mm-hmm.
There was one or two voices, in particular a fellow named Albert Rose, who was
he's got the scholarship named after him.
Absolutely, and he was a sociologist and an urban thinker at the University of Toronto, and he gave a little warning way back. Well, it was a big warning, but nobody paid attention to it. Way back in the 19, just as Regent Park, the first construction was happening, saying there's a real danger here. What's happening is that the people who live in the housing have been totally excluded from the development and management of the housing. It's like they're just another piece of furniture or something, just something that kind of be moved around to suit the convenience of all the smart people who've come up with the idea for Regent Park. And he said, this is going to be a problem. It's going to be creating a disengaged, and he didn't use these terms, these are more modern terms, but disengaged and alienated community. And, you know, the problem down through the years with Regent Park has never been the people who live there. They're smart, strong, very good people. The problem has always been the management practices of the various government agencies that over the years have had a role in Regent Park who've consistently said the tenants don't matter, they're just baggage, they're just one other thing to be dealt with in a
overhead.
Long list of...
They're overhead, yeah.
Yeah, and the current administration at Toronto Community Housing, to give them, again, some credit, they have attempted through a consultation process to more effectively engage the residents of Regent Park. But ultimately, what's driving the redevelopment of Regent Park is not a vision that's been developed jointly by the tenants, but it's fundamental land economics that in order to pay for the redevelopment, you have to cannibalize and sell off a big chunk of the existing land, and that's what's driving the income mix experiment at Regent Park. And
so, in fact, the noble goal of income mix is not really as noble as it appears. It has beneficial effects, but its initial genesis is not really about benefits to poor people. It's about economics.
Well, then, if you ask the officials, you know, why the particular mix that they've got in there of private housing and subsidized housing, why not some other mix? You know, why not 80-20 or 40-60 or 10-90 or whatever? What's the scientific rationale? What's the evidence that the mix you've got is right? I mean, then there's a bit of an embarrassed silence, and if there was an honest answer, the honest answer would be, well, this is what it takes to pay for the project. And, and again, I want to emphasize that public housing officials have been dealt a very lousy hand. They don't have the money to do the necessary repairs that any building or any set of buildings is in Regent Park need over time in order to deal with aging stock and all that sort of wear and tear and so on. So all that stuff is understandable. So I guess what I have a real concern about, though, is that there's really not enough sharp attention to the socioeconomic situation. And to be very sort of candid, 12 years from now, when Regent Park is fully redeveloped and the existing subsidized tenants are a minority within a community where there's a significant number of higher income people, my question will be, are they going to be any better off then than they are now? Now they're a bunch of poor people living in a neighborhood with a bunch of other poor people, and in 12 years, there are going to be a bunch of poor people living in a neighborhood with a bunch of rich people.
Yeah.
And but they're still going to be just as poor as they are. They're still going to have as much struggle to get jobs and to put food on the table and to make sure their kids get a decent education and all the other struggles that they have to go through every day. So what I think we need to do is make sure those socioeconomic issues are addressed. And the way to do that is to engage the residents more than just inviting them to come to a meeting, giving them some donuts and coffee, and saying, "What do you think about this fancy plan we have?" But actually identifying and working on a long-term basis in that kind of an engagement strategy.
Yep.
That's tough, and it takes money. It's something that Toronto Community Housing doesn't have.
Yep.
One of the things that public housing landlords will say when you push them real hard on these issues is they'll say, "Look, we're landlords. We're not economic development agencies. We're not social development agencies." And that's true. And what you think is what you'd like is that a public housing landlord to concentrate on being a good landlord. That would be a good thing for them to do, and that would be a wise use of their time and resources. But in these, inevitably, when income mixing comes in, claims are made which just simply cannot be supported, that somehow income mixing all by itself is going to magically transport and lift all of the wretched souls in these poor neighborhoods into the next generation of Cadillac driving upper income people, as if somehow just, you know, the very osmosis of income mixing. And that's what we need to continue challenging, and at the same time saying that the city building process has to be a lot more intentional, city building process has to be a lot more inclusive, and and we have to move beyond some of the simple-minded notions.
I appreciate that. I appreciate you taking the time to talk with us about that.
Well, it's great. Good to talk with you, as always.
You've been listening to the Wellesley Institute's Michael Shapcott talk to us about public housing, how the development of it works, and how it's impacted by the growing favor of mixed-income housing. Now we'll take a short break with a more playful inversion, Mead Lux Lewis, Bass on Top.
Before you go, can I keep you on the line to discuss one other issue that
Sure.
That's come up in Hamilton, and I wanted to explore it a little bit with you. I didn't know if it was fruitful because it was a little offside in that it's not off topic, but it's off the approach that we've taken and off the breadth of the topic that we've
Okay.
explored. Rent banks. Do rent banks offer a part solution to the housing program, and if they do, why are they targeted at people who are already being evicted? Do you understand that process at all?
Well, the rent banks, I mean, the simple answer is that they are like a Band-Aid, and like any Band-Aid, you know, Band-Aids are a good thing if you're bleeding, but they're actually not going to solve problems, especially if you've got an arterial wound and you're sort of gushing blood.
Yeah.
The problem with that's a bit of a fuzzy answer, so let me just be more specific. That we do know that the number of evictions in Ontario in the last few years has either been at or near record levels,
right,
and that most of the evictions are for households that are having trouble paying their rent, and it's generally not a big amount that leads to an eviction.
Right.
So we do know that the idea of giving somebody some emergency financial assistance in the form of a rent bank is a good idea. The problem is, however, rent banks here in Ontario tend to be very, very poorly funded, and they, in many communities, are an absolute secret. They don't want to let the word out that there's a rent bank for fear that people will actually use it.
Yeah,
the money will be gone in the first month.
Oh, I see.
So some communities actually, it's a closely held secret that there is in fact a rent bank available.
Yeah.
Other communities deal with the problem of the fact there's very little money to deal with a whole bunch of problems by writing such strong and weird administrative rules that, practically speaking, they're not much help to people.
Yeah.
But you know, fundamentally, as I mentioned, you know, Band-Aids are good for people who are bleeding, but if the bleeding gets a bit too intense, you know, probably if somebody's having trouble paying their rent this month, they almost certainly will have trouble next month and the month after, and a rent bank is really only set up to provide one-time, short-term, temporary assistance.
Yeah.
And you know, what we really need are programs that will allow for something that's a lot more realistic in terms of what people need, and so I'm you know, I'm a, the let me start again. The Ontario government sort of reluctantly set up rent banks, and then there was a there was a quiet campaign a little while back as the Ministry of Municipal Affairs and Housing was looking for ways to cut spending. It thought it could just quietly shelve the rent bank program and nobody'd notice.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, the word got out among advocates, and the ministry was very red-faced, but almost immediately
rescinded.
Yeah, it said, "Oh, you know, it was all a mistake. We were never intending to pull the money." And yeah. Sure.
Shouldn't they be tied into like financial counseling if people are having? I mean, I'm not saying that's an answer. That's another Band-Aid. But I mean, if in the meantime, incomes aren't going up and costs aren't going up, shouldn't people be given a hand in managing this?
Well,
instead of turned away because they're not being evicted yet?
Yeah, financial management is one part of it. Generally speaking, you know, people are losing their homes through evictions. Tenants are losing their homes through evictions. The number one reason is the rising cost of rents, and this is. You know, over the last 10 years, for instance, rents have increased at more than double the rate of inflation, whereas for most the what's called the median tenant household income, which is the sort of middle statistical middle income for all tenant households in the province, has actually dropped during that period of time. So many tenants have less money to pay for more rent. So no amount of financial counseling and no amount of teaching people how to sort of closely scrutinize the nickels and pennies is going to deal with the fundamental problem that if rents are going up faster than your income, you're going to be in a financial squeeze. That having been said, no question that financial management is a good thing on an individual basis. One of the other related issues here is next to the high cost of rents, the second leading cause of evictions in Ontario is the high cost of energy, and
which drives up everything.
Which drives up everything. Now, some tenants pay for their energy costs; it's buried within their rent, so they don't actually get a separate energy bill—electricity, gas, whatever form of energy they're using. But many tenants, I think it's about one in five tenant households now do have separate bills for at least some of their energy use.
Yeah.
And as the provincial government moves towards what is being called smart metering, which
is
individual metering, I think more and more households will face that they'll have a separate bill for their energy from their rent. And again, energy costs, you don't need to read the daily newspapers to know that the energy costs are literally skyrocketing and are going up even faster than the cost of rents in that last little while. And that's raising a big concern as well. Now, the province of Ontario has, and this is another very closely guarded secret, they have what's called an energy bank, which municipalities are supposed to use as a short-term, one-time temporary measure to help people who are having trouble.
It's the same thing, though. You have to have a cutoff notice before anyone will even consider your problem, and if they can't address it, you've got like very short period of time to address it alternatively.
Well that's right, and so it's driven by crisis as opposed to there's no mechanism until you reach the point of crisis to try and trigger these things. And you know, fundamentally, many of the issues that get tenants in trouble, whether it's on their rent bill or on their hydro bill or both, are some of these big questions. It's the squeeze between tight incomes and rising costs, which causes problems, and those can be addressed. There is a growing campaign throughout Ontario to create something called a universal housing benefit.
Oh.
And the idea behind the benefit, if it was designed properly, is that it would try to help bridge at least part of that gap between the high cost of maintaining your rent and the reality of declining incomes or stagnant incomes for many tenant households.
Okay. How would it do that?
Well, there's about a million different mechanisms that could be used.
We're considering mechanisms now, are we?
Well, as part of the Ontario Poverty Reduction Strategy exercise, one thing that's emerged very clearly is that one of the biggest costs that most people face, and it's especially a big cost for lower-income people, is the cost of housing and related costs like energy, water, and so on.
Yeah.
And the idea of a housing benefit, again, depending on how you design it, I've seen particular proposals that are floating around. I'll just simply say that it's a highly technical exercise to come up with a formula that that addresses the affordability gap between the actual costs and what households can afford to pay. And there's a tension at the very center of it. On the one hand, government wants to keep the costs as low as possible, so they want to make it as hard as possible for people to apply, and they want to make the benefit as small as they possibly can. You know, this is what we've been seeing on the welfare side for years and years. Governments have tried to create an income assistance system, which is virtually impossible to get on, and once you get on, it's virtually guaranteed that you're not going to be able to have enough money to
get off,
to get off, or even to enjoy some simple food and basic shelter and so on. Just the whole system is designed to be punitive rather than to help people. So if that mentality is, which we can thank in particular Mr. Harris here in Ontario with his welfare cuts back in the 1990s, and some of the particularly exquisitely cruel things that he did, like cutting
the welfare
supplement
benefit
for nursing mums and pregnant mums, on the theory that
that they only spend it on beer.
So he was really the sort of king of this kind of cruel tactic. So if the design of a new housing benefit follows that kind of pattern, then there's not going to be any real practical benefit for people. On the other hand, if the benefit actually does provide for a realistic calculation between where people's incomes actually are and what their costs actually are. And there is a form of housing benefit that's used in the province of Quebec. And it's not perfect. Some of us have some concerns about it, but it actually does deliver. It does deliver some money to people that need money. And it,
well, the things that economists exclude in terms of figuring inflation are probably things that a housing benefit would most need to consider, like the volatile costs of food and energy.
Absolutely. Now, the ironic thing is about when you talk about something like a universal housing benefit, that if you actually go back to the founding document of Mike Harris's so-called Common Sense Revolution, in there, one of the things that they say is they want to stop subsidizing investments in affordable housing, so they want to cut nonprofit and co-op housing, and they call it a billion-dollar boondoggle.
Yeah.
And instead, what they proposed was a universal. I think they called it a shelter allowance. I can't remember the exact words now.
Yeah.
But what happened, however, was once they got elected to office and they got some government economists to begin to work up some numbers, they realized that they had two choices. They could either have a benefit that would deliver no good for anyone and would be attacked as being cruel and miserly, like their welfare program was, or they could actually bring in a benefit that would actually deliver some real benefit to the roughly 1.3 million households in Ontario that probably need to have some kind of a housing benefit, and it would cost. And the Harris government ultimately decided, despite their proudly proclaiming that they always kept their promises, that was one promise they dumped. And in fact, you can go back to other right-wing governments going way back to 1984 and the election of Brian Mulroney nationally. He talked about a universal housing benefit as well until one of his officials ran the numbers and said, you know, if we're going to make this meaningful, then it's going to cost.
And
the one thing right-wing governments hate doing is
things that cost.
Things that cost for lower-income people. They don't mind benefiting oil companies or rich people, but through tax cuts. But they don't want to do things that actually help lower-income people in real ways.
If someone wanted to follow the progress of this debate about a universal housing benefit, where would they look? On the web or in the news?
To go on the web, a lot of discussion is happening in the context of the Ontario Poverty Reduction Strategy, and there's a group of community advocates. I think it's just called PovertyWatch.ca.
All right.
That's just Poverty Watch. Certainly, if you Google Poverty Watch, you'll get to the Ontario website. And there's constantly material being posted there from around the province on community campaigns. This is a grassroots campaign that's being supported by a lot of provincial organizations. And in a lot of communities around the province, people are saying, they heard the McGuinty government in the last provincial election saying that they were going to make a commitment to a poverty reduction strategy, and they said, okay, fine, we're going to take their word for it that this is one promise the Liberals may actually keep, and we're going to fight for the best poverty reduction strategy. And there's a whole series of components to a poverty reduction strategy, raising the minimum wage, getting more money into our education system, dealing with a whole variety of other factors in the health side of things and so on, but certainly housing and housing benefit would be one part of it. And a universal housing benefit is the kind of long-term solution to the rent bank, which is the Band-Aid solution. And if on a day-to-day basis or a more appropriately, a month-to-month basis, if a household is struggling on a monthly basis to be able to come up with the money to pay the landlord, giving them one-time-only rent bank grant will help them for a month, but it's probably not going to solve the underlying issues. But having
kind of akin to going to a payday loan company without the interest.
Well, yeah, and but having a housing benefit, would in fact do that. And others, as with any detailed policy, the critical question is in the detail. And you may remember about a year ago, the McGuinty government announced with great fanfare a shelter allowance program.
Mm-hmm.
I think they called it ROOF, R-O-O-F, and I've forgotten now what R-O-O-F stands for, but Residential Opportunities,
okay,
something or another. Anyway, whatever it stood for, it was a... we all got kind kind of excited because we read the first sentence of the press release about how they're going to bring in a shelter allowance for all Ontarians, and then when we read down, we realized that if it wasn't actually all Ontarians. It was only going to be for Ontarians in families with children, so that
yeah.
seniors and single people and young people and everybody else got excluded.
Shafted, yeah.
And then it you read further and find out it was only for working families and not for families on various kinds of income assistance. And,
yeah.
and in practical terms, people on income assistance generally tend to be the poorest of the poor in Ontario, and they're the ones who could most benefit. And then finally, when we read the final detail of it, it was going to be $100 a month.
Uh-huh.
And $100 a month is certainly a heck of a lot better than $0 a month. So for somebody that's struggling, getting an extra $100 in your pocket is certainly nothing to sneeze at. But we do know that in many parts of the province, you know, in cities like Toronto, for instance, for many families, the gap between what the landlord is charging, what they can afford to pay, is between $500 and $700 a month. So, $100 a month is not going to get you too far.
Yeah.
So again, you know, the initial euphoria and hearing that a year ago the province was announcing the shelter allowance program, you know, very quickly the advocates began to question as they saw the detail. And the final kicker in the announcement a year ago was it was only going to be a five-year program. And so we asked the question, what happens after the end of 5 years? And the government says, well, we stop paying the money.
Oh.
And so even that meager little $100 a month.
So designed to run just past the next election.
Well,
really.
Yeah. And you know, it was very much a political announcement, so the government can say, "Look, see, we're doing something,"
yeah.
as opposed to something that was meaningful. So when we come to a universal shelter benefit that many advocates are now saying will be an important part of the housing solution here in Ontario, the critical question, and there's a lot of interest on the part of the government. I've had meetings with government officials where they've said this is something we really want to look at very carefully, but what we're going to be doing is very carefully testing any proposals that they put forward to make sure that they actually do provide a real benefit as opposed to just simply
news.
A news and then something that's got so many exceptions and qualifications and so on that it won't be of much practical benefit to anyone.
I appreciate that, too. You've been extremely generous with your time today.
Not a problem at all.
I think
to talk with you.
I think you've given us, because we have a one-hour show, I think you've given us two broadcasts.
Well,
and,
there you go.
We're now linked to TAO, toronto.tao.ca, as well,
oh, great.
As well as radioforall.net. So, yeah, more people can get a hold of these broadcasts and these interviews and get the facts.
Well, that's important.
Yeah, thank you, Michael.
Okay, thanks a lot, then.
All right.
Yeah, okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Wellesley Institute's Michael Shapcott. In the last half of our second broadcast on the subject of housing, he's talked to us about rent banks, the temporary solution and the permanent solution to keeping people in their housing. Isn't he a charming advocate for someone so passionate and devoted lifelong to the disadvantaged? Coming up, we have Mead Lux Lewis again on an all-Mead Lux Lewis show, Lux Boogie. Thank you. Disrespect is a serious show. We deal with serious problems like premiers who don't want to give up their Visa cards for a month to find out a little bit about poverty. We have some awards this year. We're hoping to air these awards anytime there's anything serious like an election. May I have the envelope, please? From Ontario, of course, glamorous downtown Carp, Ontario, not far from Ottawa. The first award is the Mike Harris Award for Social Policy. We award this for the fight for federal funds for Ontario, but not yet for the poor or disabled. The winner, Dalton Two Gun McGuinty. Our second award comes from Salmon Arm, BC, home of the Trudeau Salute, an expression of digital joy directed to those you really think should be a quick recipient of a Darwin Award. The Darwin Awards salute the improvement of the human genome by honoring those who accidentally remove themselves from it. This is the Kijiji Award for most subtle sellout in politics, and may we have the envelope, please? This award goes to Health Minister Tony Clement, who sold out not only to the opponents of modern medicine by attacking the InSight safe injection site in Vancouver, B.C., but to meatpackers by telling us that the Listeria crisis, which is now documented to have killed 11 people across Ontario, is a sure sign that the health safety system in the food chain is working. We had considered Tony Clement for the award cabinet minister who most behaves like Mr. Bean, but in deference to Rowan Atkinson, we have shelved that proposal. We have two award suggestions from southwestern Ontario. From Punky Doodle's Corners, 7 kilometers west of Kitchener near Petersburg. This nominator must be a commuter to Hamilton because they proposed the Midas Touch Award that turns everything to mufflers. May I have the envelope, please? And the winner is Joanne Priel, the General Manager of the Community Services Department and Public Health for the City of Hamilton. In 2006, Joanne managed a department which had a gross budget of approximately $361 million, much of which was her salary, and her signal achievement has been the establishment and maintenance of interlocks and barriers in public health in response to the needs of the disadvantaged in the city. As I mentioned, there was another award nominee from Southwest Ontario, and this one comes to us from Balls Falls. Again, may I have the envelope? This is the Mr. Magoo Award, and it goes to Hamilton Medical Officer of Health, Elizabeth Richardson, who has stated that we may never know the origin of the outbreaks, currently in the news, affecting the health of Hamiltonians of Legionella or Legionnaire's disease. And now our most distinguished award for the private sector. May I have the envelope, please? Oh, dear. From Mistake Point, New Brunswick, this is the Dudley Do-Right Award, and it goes to Michael McCain, CEO of Maple Leaf Foods, who said the same thing as Hamilton's Medical Officer of Health, Elizabeth Richardson, we may never know the origin, and said it instead in reference to the Listeria outbreak across Canada, but was seen to be doing something about it and actively looking for the source.
And now a word from our sponsors. Do you suffer from nausea, heartbreak, indigestion, upset stomach or diarrhea? Does spinning in circles make you dizzy? Need more sleep? Find yourself always wanting 5 more minutes in bed? Do the random thoughts spoken out loud by your coworkers, family, and semi-friendly acquaintances suck your attention span levels into deficiency? You may be a sufferer of reality. Yes, reality. Studies show that 3 out of every 4 people are plagued daily by the highly contagious symptoms of R-E-A-L-I-T-Y. Radically easy affirmations linked intrinsically to you. If reality is affecting your career, sex life, or artistic focus, maybe it's time to try Imagisolve. Trademark of parent company, Pretend to Heal. Imagisolve is the easy way to deal with your reality. Imagisolve will ease you into a state of semi-sleep where reality sufferers can get some relief. Imagisolve is a fast-acting placebo that works by stimulating your mind into a false sense of security. Or as we at Pretend to Heal like to say, it's a blanket for your brain. We know it's hard to deal with everyday problems, and reality just adds to the pressure. Here are some actual testimonials by fictitious characters created to make you feel safe.
Hi, my name's Carl. I used to get terrible headaches from hours of bumper-to-bumper traffic, and I'd come home in a road rage and kick my dog. Then a spam email in my junk box recommended I try Imagisolve. Within 3 minutes of my first mail-order pill, I thought I felt something, and I don't kick my dog anymore. I bought a cat. My name's Wendy. I used to panic all week about what I was going to wear on a Friday night at the overpriced club with my not-so-close girlfriends. My doctor advised a proper diet and meditation, but I decided to try Imagisolve. I took my first dose on a Monday morning and slept right through till Saturday night. Now I'm not anxious about going anywhere.
Yes, folks. If reality is causing you headaches or anxiety attacks, Imagisolve may be for you. The makers of Imagisolve do not agree with your physician, but advise you to talk to the ignorant dust anyways. Imagisolve is not recommended for children under the age of puberty or still living at home, as reality may not have fully sunk in. Side effects may include, but are not limited to, dizziness while standing up, dizziness while sitting down, upset stomach, diarrhea, headaches from lack of sleep, headaches from too much sleep, mild depression, extreme depression, insomnia, poetic randomness, entwined within cerebral stimulation, menstruation, ejaculation, and shitting yourself profusely. Imagisolve is not an authentic medication, and should be taken with a pinch of sarcasm. Any resemblance to actual medicine is highly unlikely. If side effects persist beyond the grave, please consult your mortician. Reality is a very serious affliction, and if you're unsure of your condition, tell a police officer, I'm about to rob a bank. Under no condition should Imagisolve be ingested with or without food. The makers of Imagisolve own copyrights in the words imagination and solve, and may deem necessary to tax your speech if you are on or attempting to take any pretend to heals play hidden products. Reality should be treated as serious in all situations, except situations you choose to ignore. Please don't listen to your doctor, blow all symptoms out of proportion, and remember, if there was a good disease to catch, reality is it. After all, there's nothing Imagisolve can't pretend to heal without a little dose of a cleverly named medication and a less clever slogan. Imagisolve. It works. Why? Because you want it to. Sign up now for our trial offer, pop one pill, I'll even take two. Gypsy Eyes, back to you.
That was poet and presenter Tommy Buick, who may be again at Sky Dragon on Monday, September the 8th, 7:30 p.m. for slam poetry readings. Our thanks also for conceptual contribution to the awards to Bob the Knob and The Stranger on the Bus. And now, Carter Ballooney in Sanctuary in Montreal in St. Gabriel's Church, dodging deportation while he awaits approval of a second application to be landed in Canada. Carter Ballooney.
I feel like no energy.
Yeah, well, I felt the same way yesterday. I don't know why.
Yeah. And today, like, I feel like up the morning, I said, okay, I feel okay. I opened the TV, I opened the radio, my computer.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah?
Yeah, I heard the news, like...
What happened today?
Like a big explosion in Algeria.
Explosion?
Yeah, like suicide explosion.
Why? Well, I missed that.
Car.
Big explosion and what?
Like a terrorist attack.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Thank you.
They killed 43 civilians.
Yeah, 43. Where?
Yeah, it's on the, like... like in school, like next to Algiers, in the next capital.
Oh, all right.
60 kilometers in the next capital.
43. Do you have friends in Algiers?
Oh, maybe. I don't know. Yeah, I have some friends, but I don't know. I don't think so. I have friends from this place, but like
okay.
A long time ago, maybe somebody moved this place, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Just yesterday, 12 soldiers died, the count.
Yeah.
And today, 43 civilians.
Yeah.
I know. And Algeria started in 1992.
Right.
Yeah, now, like.
When did you leave?
15 years now, it doesn't stop.
When did you leave Algeria?
96.
Okay.
That's too much. It happened today, and yesterday, and a few days ago. And wow, that's too much. That's like 1 week ago, 21 killed too, 21 person killed. And
yeah.
Yeah, it's just too much. Like between like 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, like more than 100 died.
100?
Yeah,
more than 100?
Oh,
what,
yeah.
Bombs, did you say?
Yeah, with the bombs, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. That depressed me a lot. Yeah. One, thinking about that, like, man, that's too much.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like nothing can make me happy.
Yeah.
I don't know. Just like 2 years and 7 months waiting between four walls, and like, and I'm hearing another news coming from Algeria, the bad news. That's making me like this is torture. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
All this bad news, nothing like ops. I hope I got one good news.
Well, you're waiting for that good news, aren't you?
Yeah, wait, like, you know?
Yeah.
Just, you have to wait sometimes, like I'm waiting. When you open the radio, when you open the TV, you see, like, something, like, very bad. It just crack you down, you know? Just crack me down.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
I hope one day the explosion in Algeria to stop, man. That's too much.
Yeah.
You know how many, like, I saw Algerian TV, the civilian talk to journalists, everybody was angry, man.
So at the church, everything is fine?
Yeah, everything's fine for now.
Yeah.
Like, nothing new, it's fine.
Yeah. I hear you. Okay.
Yeah, I'm just waiting and...
Yeah.
Waiting to good news anytime.
Yeah, okay.
I know nothing.
Yeah.
Just like wait and shut. It's like shut your mouth and wait. You know? That's what I feel.
Well, you're talking now. That's you've got the chance to share that now.
Yeah.
I know how frustrating that is.
Yeah, just like shut your mouth and do nothing and just like hey.
Yeah.
Like that's what I feel.
Yeah. Well, that's about the way it is too, isn't it? I put in a complaint to the Law Society, and the Law Society said, we don't want to hear your complaint. I said to the Law
Society,
I said to the Law Society, you know, a lot of us are very unhappy right now, and I wouldn't think you would want to be seen to be making unhappy people more unhappy, you know, because we're really unhappy.
Yeah.
And I wait to hear what they say.
I'm not happy. That's true. I feel like...
Yeah.
I feel like I'm not happy. I'm like, oh man.
Yeah.
It's like, like.
Well, did you get outside? Did you get into the sun?
I didn't go.
You didn't go?
No. Like when I feel like I had this news this morning.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you need the vitamin D, though. Mm. All right, man.
Okay.
Yeah? But you're going to be well till the next time I talk to you, right?
Yeah.
All right. Good.
We'll talk on Monday.
Okay. We'll talk on Monday at 3:30. All right, Carter. Have a good night.
Take care.
Thanks.
Bye.
And now to take us out. Mead Lux Lewis. Detroit Jump. Come back next week for more Carter. More disrespect. You can now listen to the show wherever you're near the internet. Disrespect is streamed live at http://cfmu.mcmaster.ca. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at Showtime, Thursdays at noon, 93.3 FM, CFMU, to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.